This week on the show, Rick and Morty's Chris Parnell. From the Flophouse podcast and The Daily Show, Dan McCoy. Plus, Andres Parada. It's the Novelizers.
Don't want your popcorn. Don't want your milk duds. Don't want my shoes stuck in pools of sticky cola. Don't show me romance. Don't show me fist fights. Just show me words printed out under the book lights. Yeah, baby, novelize the movie. Any sentences, paragraphs, and nothing to see. Yeah, novelize the movie. Write a book and turn it into a podcast.
Welcome to the Novelizers. Steven here. Dave is on vacation, but filling in for him is internet superstar Tony Zarrett. How's it going, Tony?
Yeah, it's going great. Well, it is now that I get to be on a podcast. I mean, this is a pretty rare treat as a middle-aged white man to be involved in talking to someone on a podcast.
Wait, so, this isn't just any podcast. This is a podcast where we talk about old movies we remember from our childhood. Surely we're the only one.
Yeah, it seems like too niche of an interest. Movies?
Yeah.
Why? I mean, sure, there's podcasts about things like worm anatomy that the broad audience wants to learn about. But yeah, movies.
We don't do it for the listeners, Tony.
I can tell. Yeah.
Ooh. Anyway, this isn't just any movie podcast. This is the Novelizers. And this is a podcast where we take classic films and then we break them down into scenes and get different comedy writers to turn them into books, because books are always better than the movies. And then we get a fun actor, comedian to narrate. And in fact, Tony.
Yeah.
Who do we have on the show today?
You're not going to believe it. We have, first of all, Chris Parnell. We're huge fans of him. Of course, he's on Rick and Morty. He was Dr. Spitzemann on 30 Rock. Archer, he's been on SNL. And even, he's been in an audiobook called DC's Batman, The Audio Adventures. And this is, just to warn everybody, the Batman is a guy who dresses up like a bat. So it's not like a Wolfman situation, if that scares you. Then we have Dan McCoy, co-host of the Flophouse podcast, which is, you're not going to believe this, is also about old movies. So I forgot to mention, I did know of one other podcast about this niche topic. And he's also a writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And finally, Andres Parada is a comedian and a performer at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and on the Groundlings. And he's also been on America's Got Talent, Just for Laughs, and more.
Is there any more?
No, that's all of it. Maybe the Magnet Theater.
I mean, is there any more to life?
No, not that America's Got Talent.
Right.
And anyways, should I continue?
I don't know. No, but why don't you're a huge Batman fan. That's why I booked you on the show today, right?
Yeah, I love Batman. Everything from the fact that he's called Batman to the fact that he's a man. I mean, all these things are great about Batman. But in all seriousness, I've seen a number of Batman movies over the years, and he's a really cool guy, and I love his adventures.
If you could be any superhero, Tony, why would you be Batman?
Well, I guess he owns his own car, and it's expensive, especially where I live, and he has his own garage. And, you know, I'm here in New York. It's almost impossible to find parking, so just turning into these Batman movies is kind of an escapist fantasy whenever he gets to take his car out of his, solo garage and drive it to this crime scene without having to pay for parking.
Yeah, like escape from New York into a new, whole new world called Gotham City. Well, Chris Parnell, novelize us.
I thought it was a question. Sorry, no, I don't have anything else. Oh, Batman has a friend named Robin.
Not in this movie, he doesn't.
Right.
That was too fun and joyful.
Yeah, right. This was the very serious.
Yeah,
Batman.
This movie is that they had no joy.
Do you remember whatsoever. This is the last thing I'm going to bring up because I know this is just it. But I remember in the very end of the last Batman movie of this run, he's like Alfred or whatever. Somebody has gone into hiding, and then there's a waiter at this table. And the waiter goes, the guy goes, "What's your name?" And the waiter says, "Robin." And it's like, and that was like the very end of the third one, and they never followed up on that.
Yeah. But it's just for our imaginations can run wild where that might go.
For our fan fiction. Sorry, go ahead.
Chris Parnell, novelize us.
The Dark Knight, Chapter 12, The 100% Real, No Takesies-Backsies Death of Jim Gordon. Novelized by Dan McCoy, narrated by Chris Parnell. Gotham's top newsman, Anthony Michael Hall, psyched himself up before his live broadcast. "Come on, geek," he muttered to himself. "Get this one right." No matter how many protein shakes he slammed, some sick part of him still felt like the nerd who got an F in shop class and brought a flare gun to school. "Just don't call him the Bartman on air again. Don't call him the Bartman on air again," he muttered. The camera light blinked, and he dove in. With no word from the Batman, all of the cops at this bullshit huge funeral that police and no other civil servants somehow get have to be wondering if the Joker will make good on his threat to kill the mayor. He smiled. He had successfully done his job of reading words. And now back to Judy in the studio with a special investigation into how news reports are an easy way to deliver exposition. Back at Bartman's headquarters, Alfred looked at some computers. "Alfred!" Bruce Wayne barked as he wheeled a motorcycle from his spare motorcycle closet. "I've narrowed it to four possibles." Alfred furrowed his brow, dubious that Bruce had somehow found the only four suspects, but he decided not to argue, lest he receive another lecture about how Batman was the world's greatest detective while Bruce brandished a Batman comic subtitled World's Greatest Detective as proof. Instead, he checked if any of the suspect lived within sniper's distance of the parade, just as he was taught in butlering school. "The one in 1502 has a criminal record," Alfred shouted back, knowing how much his billionaire employer loved to profile ex-cons. Personally, Alfred thought that maybe if Master Wayne pumped more of his wealth into social programs rather than bat cosplay, he'd need to spend less time throwing bat-shaped metal at the mentally ill. But the last time he'd brought it up, Bruce had laughed and accused him of voting for Nader and had left an oat milk latte and a vegan omelet at his bedside every breakfast for a month. Better to let Bruce work out his psychosexual issues on his own. Alfred was British, and he needed his morning beef sausage and gallon of beans. "Smell you later, Alfie," Bruce screamed as he zoomed away. "Sir, is there any reason you're not wearing your Batman costume?" Alfred yelled after him. "Yes," Bruce yelled back, not wanting to explain how the laundromat had shrunk it. That would only lead to more questions, and time was of the essence. Meanwhile, the previous commissioner's parade was in full swing. Marching bagpipers blared away, as per every dying person's funeral wishes.
"Make sure the music at my wake is somehow both droning and abrasive," the precorpses always stipulate. "Preferably the sound of a big bag of air being squeezed through a tube to evoke the strangled cry of my last breath. But you know, classy."
In the crowd, policemen scanned for threats. Lieutenant Jim Gordon looked skyward, exposing his mustache bristles to the vitalizing glow of Earth's yellow sun. "Yes, yes, grow, my pretties," he murmured to the whiskers. Soon, he could charge $2 for mustache rides. "How are we doing on the roof?" he queried into his walkie-talkie.
"Oh, it's great up here," an officer replied. "There's a pool and everything."
"I meant, are there any threats?" Gordon retorted.
No, everything's good. Over and out."
Gordon frowned. He thought he'd heard splashing and an indistinct Marco Polo. Meanwhile, Bruce Wayne arrived, still in his street clothes. I don't know, maybe he had like an armored undershirt on, but from where I'm sitting, novelizing this thing, it seems like an oversight on his part. Like, maybe it was for stealth, but on the other hand, how stealthy can you be when everyone would be like, "Hey, isn't that billionaire playboy Bruce Wayne breaking into that building?" But I guess that's why he's the world's greatest detective, and I novelize things for exposure and two cans of beanie weenies. At street level, the mayor stood up to deliver the eulogy. He leaned to an aide and whispered, "Watch me suck the police union's dick." The aide smiled politely and wondered whether Nestor Carbonell wore mascara. Bounding to the stage like a prizefighter, the mayor raised both arms and boomed into the mic. "Batman has rocket launchers. Why not the police?" As the crowd erupted, the mayor danced around the stage, pointing at officers in the audience. "You get a rocket launcher! You get a rocket launcher! Everybody gets a rocket launcher!" Then his face grew somber, and he adopted a sober tone. "But we're here today to honor the memory of our fallen comrade, Police Commissioner What's-His-Face.
You know, old Watsy's policies were never very popular. I'd get calls every day from people he'd personally stopped and frisked on his off hours just because he had a passion for frisking people. You've heard about a very hungry caterpillar? Well, we had a very frisky commissioner. Here the mayor paused for laughter that failed to arrive. That's it. I'm sticking Bruce Valanche in Arkham, the mayor muttered, tearing up his note cards. Point is, the mayor continued, people were always complaining the commissioner was turning Gotham into a police state, and I can think of no greater way to honor his memory than to continue that important work. Just this morning, someone got lightly shoved on the subway. The crowd of police gasped. I know, horrible. The mayor bit his lip, empathetic. And that's why I'm announcing the deployment of 80,000 more cops to our subways and buses. That ought to be some sweet overtime for you jag-offs. The mayor grinned like a shark with an excellent dentist as the crowd erupted in thunderous applause. Far above, Bruce Wayne, still not disguised in his batsuit, entered room 1502 to find several police officers tied up with blindfolds over their eyes. Phew, he thought. Blindfolds, that's convenient. Leaning down to one of the officers, he shifted his voice. What happened here? Hold on, that's not it. I sound like Droopy Dog. He coughed, did a couple of test growls, and tried again. What happened? This? Ah, we're just practicing shibari, the beautiful, sensual art of Japanese rope bondage. Really? Said Bruce, taken aback. No, dude, the Joker stole our uniforms. Silently placing a bat tracker on the sarcastic cop so he could stalk and leave him a bat upper decker later, Bruce glanced at the window, where someone had left a telescope and an egg timer. What kind of sick freak would time an egg that's cooking across the street? Bruce mused to himself. He approached the window. Well, there's no reason I can think of to not put my eye on this mysterious scope positioned near the site of an assassination threat, he thought. As the world's greatest detective put his eye to the eyepiece, the egg timer rang loudly, announcing that this detective was hard-boiled. The blind flew up, revealing Bruce at the window with a sniper scope, causing the police to open fire, although honestly, most of them were planning to shoot at the window anyway, just for funsies. Bruce recoiled, only to discover he now had a charcoal black eye from the telescope. The Joker truly was the clown prince of crime. On the ground, the 21-gun salute turned their 21 guns to the stage, causing the security team to think, oh yeah, that policeman threatening the mayor has Joker mouth scars, duh. I can be so scatterbrained sometimes. Guess someone's got a case of the Mondays. The Joker shot his gun, and Lieutenant Gordon leapt like a mustachioed Baryshnikov in front of the bullet, yelling, make sure my funeral is even bigger, and get someone better to speak at it than you, Mr. Mayor, the governor maybe, or Flavor Flav. As Gordon collapsed, lifelessly, a police officer shook his head grimly as if to say, if this man shows up alive later on, it would most certainly raise narrative questions about when the plan to pretend he died was hatched. Meanwhile, District Attorney One-Face made sure his girlfriend, Rachel Dawes, was safe by trusting a police officer who probably was a normal police officer and not a Joker goon, 50-50 if flipping a coin was something you might be into. Then he burst into a paddy wagon where one of the shooters lay handcuffed. Tell me what you know about the Joker, he growled. What's his height? Is he involved with anyone? Does he have problematic political views? Will he show feet on Maine? The shooter just smiled creepily, then glanced down at his name tag. It read, Officer Rachel Dawes. For a moment, the DA smiled. Hey, you have the same name as my girlfriend. Then it sank in. Officer Rachel Dawes was threatening regular Rachel Dawes. One Face growled. I should have known you were up to something when I noticed you were played by character actor David Dasmalkian of the Suicide Squad in Late Night with the Devil, he muttered, grabbing the van's keys to drive it somewhere more torture-friendly. Late that evening, the same solemn-faced officer who had been at Lieutenant Gordon's side when he definitely 100% died stopped by Gordon's house to break the totally true news. I'm sorry, he said to Gordon's widow and his son. He's gone. I promise you. I mean, imagine how fucked up this would be if I was lying about that to his kid. Forget about it. He grinned, then cried, then grinned again, then sneezed to cover it up. Later, the cop stood with his colleague shining the bat signal into the air. Switch it off, he said. The bat ain't interested in talking to us. But God help whoever he does want to talk to, he added grimly. He has a lot of opinions about cryptocurrency.
Thank you, Chris Parnell. We'll be right back with more Novelizers right after this. And we are back each week on the... Well, first of all, while you had that 10 minutes of listening to that narration, any more insights about Batman? What about the Joker? Do you like him as a villain? He's creepy.
Well, I'll be honest. It's pretty scary when someone tells jokes, but you know what's more scarier than jokes? Riddles.
Oh, yeah.
They're like jokes with an attitude. So they should make a character that's like the Joker, but does riddles. Just an idea I had, but
yeah, it seems a little similar. I don't know.
No, yeah, no, no. It's totally different. A riddle is a way different than a joke. Not related at all.
What about brain teasers? Could that be a villain?
Yeah. Or pranks.
The prankster.
Quips. Yeah. I came up with something called the Prankler for my YouTube channel when I found out that the Joker was already taken.
Speaking of your YouTube channel, how do we find the 10,000 listeners, 1,000, whatever?
Well, you just type my name in.
Yeah. What is your name?
Tony Zaret, T-O-N-Y-Z-A-R-E-T. You can type it in to the search bar.
Nice. The internet will handle the rest. Yeah. Each week on the show, we talk to someone who actually worked on the film The Dark Knight. And this week, Christine Bullen talked to Christopher Nolan's stand-in. Not sure what that job is, but I guess we will find out. Let's hear that interview.
Hello, and welcome to the interview portion of the Novelizers. My name is Christine, and today I am joined by a very special guest who worked on the film The Dark Knight. Today we are joined by Renato, and from what I'm reading here, you were the stand-in for Christopher Nolan? Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was on the set the entire time doing stand-in for the director, which is a little known position, but yeah, it takes a lot of effort.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I've never heard of this because stand-ins, as far as I understand it, are usually for actors, on-screen performers who would need someone to stand in when they go to makeup or when they've been on set for too long. So what would be the purpose of a stand-in for the director?
Okay, so let's say that you're an actor and they need to test out all of the lights on you and test out, oh, how was the shot going to look? For the director, he has to know about his chair. How was that chair going to be? Christopher Nolan is very precise, very, very particular. So I make sure that everything is correct before Christopher comes in.
Okay, so then this is at the request of Christopher himself. He requested to have a stand-in?
It's a unionized project, so he does not want this, but the union necessitates. Once you get over a certain amount of millions of dollars, there has to be a stand-in. I was the stand-in on a lot of movies for the director.
Okay, so what other movies have you worked on? Who have you been a stand-in for?
Do you remember the movie Simon Birch?
I do. Yeah, I do. Wow, blast from the past. I do.
I was the stand-in for the man who directed that as well.
Do you know his name?
Yeah.
Do you want to share that?
Nah, it was too long ago. We have bad blood on that movie set, so
What happened?
I had to slurp Pepsis for hours testing to make sure is this good for the director. And I don't like Pepsis. And my stomach gets big and I get cranky. And before you know it, I'm on a bad mood.
I want to just dig into this so I understand this role a little more clearly. Yeah. So if you're testing Pepsi for a director, you're a stand-in,
mm-hmm.
What exactly would you be relaying to him? What's the point?
Yeah, so he comes and he sits down and then I have an interface with him. Let's say for Christopher Nolan, for example, it was not Pepsi, it was Coca-Cola Zero. He comes in and he says, hey, Renato, how was it? And I said, I drank 6 Coca-Cola Zeros. They're all from the same pack. They're all ice cold, just the way that you like it, sir. And then he says, okay, and how is the chair? And I say, well, I've been sitting here since last night and it still is good. And then he says, okay.
Wouldn't drinking 1 Coca-Cola suffice? Why would you need to drink 6?
Because sometimes a director gets 1 Coca-Cola or LaCroix, depending on what type of guy that we're talking about. Then he gets another one and goes, oh, that one is too warm compared to what I'm used to. ah! And then they say, that's why you test multiple. If, for example, you don't have one camera on set, right?
Yeah.
Imagine The Dark Knight and they have one camera. That's a bad movie. Imagine The Dark Knight now only has one Coke Zero. Same logic. You need to have multiple of everything. It's a Hollywood trick.
The stakes for one do feel a lot higher than the other. But I understand that directors can be very particular. I understand that. Now, did you have a good relationship with him?
Yeah, very good. I mean, I knew his children very, very well because once he gets to set, I have to stand in for his personal life. So most of my job is driving his kids to school, cooking dinner for his wife, going to the bank.
Now this role is shifting for me in terms of how, because now I'm thinking you're his personal assistant.
But it's called stand-in because of the union.
Got it.
A personal assistant doesn't sit in a chair and drink Coke Zero, do they?
And test it out for him? Gosh, I guess not typically. I wouldn't assume that, no.
Yeah.
But I would assume a stand-in would take his kids to school or cook dinner.
But that's the thing, is that it's not standing for just there. You don't get to stop standing in. Like, for example, this, okay? When you're an actor, right? And you have a stand-in, then when you come into the set, they go and sit where you were sitting down, right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
You can't keep standing in when they start acting, or else the footage would be, why is there a second guy who looks like the other guy?
Oh, right. They definitely leave the set. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to shoot both of you.
Yeah. I mean, we're fighting for that. The union is trying to get that to happen. But so far, no wins.
I would change movies completely.
Yeah. It would make it a lot more because then I get residuals. Right now, I'm not getting residuals for taking his daughter to ballet.
It really feels like you sort of have two jobs. You are a stand-in. You are on set. You're, you know, in his director's chair. You're testing things out. You're probably testing food and obviously drinks and things like that. But then, you know, when he comes and sits down, he's in the chair. He's doing the director job. Then you move into a whole new role where you are really kind of like in his life as his life stand-in. Which version of the role do you like the most?
Well, I can tell you this. It's getting uncomfortable doing the life stuff because his kids are calling me dad. And that feels weird for me. And his wife is in love with me now.
Oh,
and wow. I gotta do it because that's what he does when he's there. But I don't like that. I don't want to have a babies. The reason why I got this job is because I wanted to sit down and drink six Coke Zeros in a row. But that's the thing. If you're an actor, you gotta audition, right? Nobody likes it. There are things that you have to do. For me, I have to have a family. I don't want that.
Were you intimate with his wife? Did it go that far?
We do have another baby that does not look like Christopher Nolan. But this is, you know, I'm getting used to this. When I was a stand-in for Harmony Korine, I had to get addicted to heroin.
Oh my.
That was hard.
Harmony Korine, who is that?
The director for the movie Gummo. Did you ever see the movie Gummo in the 1990s? He also wrote the film Kids about the AIDS epidemic. Do you remember that movie?
I don't, but now I'm feeling like I should.
He was kind of a problematic director in the early 90s. He was known for having a lot of addiction and stuff. So when I was standing in for him, I had to go do all that stuff.
And who's making you do this? Is it the director himself? Because you were saying earlier that Christopher Nolan didn't even want this, but this is a unionized role. So who is enforcing that you are going this far, like in this role as a stand-in?
The stand-in union and my own integrity. Mm. If I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it right.
There's a stand-in union?
Yeah, there's a stand-in union, the SSI. Stand-in, sir. Incredible.
Wow. I honestly, like, to me, this feels like the hardest role on the film. Like, you know, for method actors, I mean, specifically talking about this film, Heath Ledger in the role of the Joker, how devastating it was that he was so, you know, committed to this role and potentially led to his own death. And it sounds to me like you were experiencing something similar to that in a lot of ways. I mean, you are literally having to become the director, not only on set, but in his personal life. This is like method acting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just to take a little bit of credit for the Joker's performance in that movie, when I was sitting in the chair, I had a producer for the movie come up and they said, "Hey, quick question. Do we want Heath Ledger to go method or not? You're the stand-in right now, so you have to answer that question." And I said, "Yeah, make him do that." So that was my decision.
Wow. So there's a part of you that's holding the weight of the death of one of the greatest American actors of our time. How do you sleep at night?
With Christopher Nolan's wife.
Are you still? This movie was almost 20, is almost 20 years old now.
Basically, the way that it works is once you start standing in, you have to keep standing in as long as they're active in the industry. That's our form of residuals to make sure that I keep making money.
It makes sense that you're going to build that relationship with his family, the understanding of who he is as a person, and continue that relationship.
Yes, absolutely correct. It gets complicated once you start working for multiple directors at the same time. I'm doing a lot of Mrs. Doubtfire right now. A lot of being on a table for dinner with multiple directors' wives and having to snap back and forth between them and go, "Okay, yes, Mrs. Spielberg, I love you too." And then I have to quick go over here and say, "And I love you too, Mrs. Nolan."
Wow. Well, they know, like if they're all at a table together, they understand what's happening and they're just going with this.
The thing is that Christopher Nolan doesn't cheat on his wife. He's a good man. So I'm not allowed to cheat on my wife. That's why when I'm with the other ones, I have to say, "I'm not doing that," or else I will be violating the standard.
So your commitment is to one director first. You only sleep with one director's wife, and that's Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
So you're not sleeping with Steven Spielberg's wife.
Yeah.
But how far do you go?
First base, holding hands, kissing. And the benefit of that is that that is what the Spielbergs normally do. They are not known for lots of affection. So it works out.
Not a very lustful relationship between the two of them.
And you can tell that by his movies. There's not an ounce of lust in E.T. I look for it. I keep watching it, hoping that I'll see something.
Well, different movies are meant to do different things. I don't think E.T. was necessarily meant to be lustful.
Oh.
So, you've got Christopher Nolan. You've got Steven Spielberg. Are there any other directors you're actively working with right now?
Yeah. Do you know Tim Allen?
Yeah.
He's getting into directing. You know, he's directing the Shaggy Dog 2. Do you remember the Shaggy Dog 1?
Gosh, I don't. And what's his personal life like, and how invested are you in that scene?
Well, luckily he's not doing drugs no more, but I do have to be a Republican, which is a bit of a challenge. I got to keep going to Trump rallies. I got to make signs and hold them up. That's hard. I don't want to do that.
Especially if it doesn't align with your real personal beliefs.
Yeah. I'm a political anarchist, so anything is hard.
Yeah.
But this is how movies get made.
So it's a sacrifice for the movie industry, and you believe in the magic of movies.
Absolutely. And every time that somebody looking up at the big screen watching Dark Knight and it looks beautiful, I say, "I was there." All of the times that the cameras weren't rolling, I was there.
Do you see an end date in this profession for yourself?
Yes. I'm a little bit younger than Christopher Nolan. So when he, God rest his soul, passes in the very, very distant future, I will finally be able to stop this curse of a life that I have fallen into.
What will you do then?
Maybe do like farm.
Do farm.
Corns. Sit out there, pop open a Coke Zero, and drink it because I like it, not because I have to.
Renato, I want to thank you for joining us today and shedding light on a part of the industry that I didn't even know existed. And I will look at directors differently. And I will know that, wow, you know, I see a behind the scenes picture and they've got the microphone and the headset or whatever, and know that someone was doing that right before they were to make sure it looked good for that photo.
It was me.
That's our show for today. Thanks, Tony, for dropping by and hanging out with me.
No problem.
Yeah. What else have you got going on this week?
You can just go to my YouTube channel. Just type my name in the search bar and look up what I posted.
Yeah, so, that's what you've done this week.
Yeah.
Okay.
I posted something. I don't know when this is coming out, but I just love to post stuff. So
it's coming out on Monday.
Yeah.
So if you have any upcoming
posts,
anything,
yeah, just posts. Search for my name and then my okay. posts.
All right.
Because I could tell you I don't have the posts posted. I'm sure I'll have posted something, so keep an eye out for my post.
Tony spills the tea on his private life on the Novelizers podcast. Special thanks to Tony. Special thanks to this week's guests, Chris Parnell, Dan McCoy, Andres Parada. See you next time. Bye-bye.
The Novelizers is hosted by me, Dave Hill, with Stephen Levinson, and produced by Stephen, Dennis DiClaudio, Cole Emhoff, Graham Douglas, Kevin Carter, Christine Bolin, Rob Kuttner, and Marla Ratner, and distributed by Cincinnati Public Radio. Editing and mixing by Graham Douglas. Music by Cole Emhoff. Theme song by Andrew Lynn, recorded by Knotts. Additional editing by Andrew Lynn and Sunita Haberlein. Special thanks to Brad Combs and Parabolic Studio in Manhattan. Follow The Novelizers on Instagram and support us on Patreon. The Novelizers is written and recorded without the use of AI. The Novelizers is an unauthorized work of parody. Copyright 2025, Novelizers, LLC.